Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Chris Sidorek. When a mass shooting occurs, like we saw in Dayton and El Paso just over a week ago, we're all left wondering the same things. Why? And how do we prevent the next tragedy? Here to help shine at least some light on that is James Silver, assistant professor of criminal justice at Worcester State University. He's the co-author of a 2018 study for the FBI titled A Study of the Pre-Attack Behaviors of Active Shooters in the United States between 2000 and 2013. Professor Silver, welcome to Radio Boston.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me, Chris. I appreciate it.
So for this study, you looked at 160 active shooter incidents in the U.S. between 2000 and 2013, 63 individual shooters. What were the commonalities you found about who the shooters were?
Well, first of all, we actually only looked at 63 events. The FBI originally studied 160 of these shooting events, these active shooting events. And we actually took what we call a deep dive into 63 of them. So the commonalities we found were, frankly, not that encouraging in terms of what everyone wants, which is, can we predict this?
Right.
So what we found is they're overwhelmingly male, which is, I don't think, surprising to too many people. But that's not really very specific when it comes to trying to predict these things. So you say men, great, age range. Just in our study alone, our youngest shooter was 12. The older shooter was 88. So we're basically talking about every post-pubescent male in America.
So was there anything about the shooters that gave you a hint of why?
The why is a very complicated question. What we found is that in this study and in other studies that are related to this about mass shooters, there's normally what we call a grievance. Now, a grievance is maybe not what it means in common parlance. We mean something more than just being angry, right? This isn't just a little bit of road rage or I'm mad at a coworker. A grievance is something that's sort of like we refer to as sort of a wound that won't heal. It's a sense that you've been wronged in this world. There's an injustice and you need to correct it. And so it becomes sort of an organizing principle for these folks. And what we find is almost all of them have some grievance. What that grievance is really varies. It can be something as mundane as I'm being treated unfairly at work. It could be racially based. It could be misogyny. There's just so many different reasons that go into a grievance.
Yeah, and you were actually quoted in a New York Times article talking about the role of misogyny in mass shootings. Would you say that's just one component and it's more complicated than that, it sounds like?
I would. I would say it's definitely more complicated than that. And misogyny is certainly something that's come up in mass shootings recently, but it's also come up in mass shootings over the past 30 or 40 years. So it's nothing new. It's become noticed now. But there's other things that have gone into mass shootings like hate crimes, like just anger at a neighbor. Sometimes there's mental health issues. And I think what we would say from this report and other research I've done is probably almost every one of these shootings is what we would call multifactorial. There's a bunch of different threads that go into forming a grievance.
So you mentioned mental health there. That is very commonly one of the things that is sparked in the public conversation after incidents like we saw in Dayton and El Paso. What role did you find mental health played?
So in the 63 shooters that we looked at, we could only identify 25% had a diagnosed mental illness before the shooting. That sounds like a pretty high number. But
I thought it was kind of low, actually, when I saw that.
Well, that's great. That's an interesting take on it. So a lot of people, I guess, do think that mental illness drives almost all of this. And that's just not the case. So we found 25% had a diagnosed mental illness. Of course, there could be underlying mental illnesses that aren't diagnosed because people don't go for care, care isn't accessible, whatever that might be. It's important to recognize, too, the lifetime prevalence of mental illness in adults in the United States is around 50%. So the fact that many of these people have either diagnosed mental illness or maybe those around them saying they showed signs of mental illness really shouldn't be surprising. That's about half the adults in the U.S. It's unlikely, at least from the studies I've done, this FBI study among others, that mental illness is the driving factor, the master explanation for most of these active shooting incidents.
One of the other issues I think that commonly enters public conversation after these incidents is gun control. Mm-hmm. I was struck by looking through your research that the vast majority of guns used in these incidents were legally purchased. 40%, the biggest portion, were bought with the explicit purpose of carrying out the shooting. And then another 35% of the shooters already owned the weapons. What did you make of that?
It's very interesting to understand that most of these mass shooters or active shooters are probably not prohibited by at least federal law from purchasing a gun if they want to. Most of them don't have a mental illness that has made them involuntarily committed. Most of them did not have the type of disqualifying criminal records that would keep them from buying a gun. So most of them can just buy a gun.
But that feels right, like a real failure on our part, if that is the case.
It may be a failure. It is a reality, though. It is true that they can buy them. I did another study of 115 mass murderers, and those are people who killed at least four people in one incident. And only 4% of them would have been prohibited from legally purchasing a gun if they bought it just for the purpose of the attack they eventually carried out.
4%?
4%. Most of them had the gun already or just went out and legally purchased it. Some did borrow it / stole it from a friend. But access to guns is a very difficult issue, and it's hard to keep the people who do these shootings from getting guns because they don't have the backgrounds that you might think they do. They're not delusional or psychotic, and they don't have serious criminal records.
So we're going to come back to that aspect, but I want to ask about how these shooters behaved before an attack, because that's one of the things that you were really driving at with the report.
What we found is there's a large number of warning signals. Now, I want to be clear, in this report we talked about this, and in other studies I've talked about this. We're not saying we're blaming anybody for not bringing a person to the attention of law enforcement. This isn't about blame or responsibility. But in looking at these shooters, we found that they do have many warning signs. We were able to find, you know, 3 to 5 warning signs or concerning behaviors per individual.
Can you give us an example of what those
are? Sure. A very common thing is what we in sort of the threat assessment and criminology field call behavioral leakage. This is a person indicating that they're going to do harm to another person. They're going to attack somebody. They're going to kill somebody. They'll say it in a blog. They'll talk about it with friends. It may not be something even that direct, but it could be a threat. If I get fired, I'm coming back. You know I've got guns. It's really quite amazing how often people will tell others around them what they're going to do. So it's probably human nature to disregard it, to try and downplay that, to not think the worst of the person you hear it from. But overwhelmingly, in school shootings, workplace shootings, all types of public shootings, people have actually said what they were going to do and then did it. So what we found is that and other types of warning behaviors, like a sudden fascination with guns, increased anger levels that are just disproportionate to the situations, are the types of things that could be noticed. We call them observable behaviors, and they can be seen. What we hope is that if people see them, they might take them seriously enough to report them to law enforcement.
Yeah, so that was kind of your big underlying point here, is that you would encourage folks, if they are close to someone that is exhibiting these behaviors, to report them to law enforcement or to what's
probably
the solution?
It's probably going to be law enforcement, right? That's who people would know to go to. I think it's important, though, that people understand if you report somebody because they have this concerning behavior, the person you're reporting probably hasn't committed a crime yet. So law enforcement, if they do what is, I think, a best practice, use a threat assessment approach, they will be more interested in problem solving for the person of concern and less interested in punishment delivery. So it's really about saying, can we help this person? Because they seem to be heading towards a very tragic end, and let's move them off this pathway to violence.
So this is where I want to come back to the access to guns, because if you look at the El Paso incident, the mother of the shooter did that, talked to law enforcement, said, I am concerned over the weapon that my son owns. And there wasn't anything they could do. He was legally able to own that weapon.
Which is really – that's a great question, because that gets right to what I want to talk about, which is threat assessment. So what happened in that case – and this is just from my reading of reports, so I don't really know for sure. But the police said he has not committed a crime yet. And that's true. You can't go arrest somebody for legally owning a gun. Had those police officers or that law enforcement agency used a threat assessment approach, they might have said, okay, the person hasn't committed a crime, but can we do something to intervene because somebody is clearly concerned? A threat assessment team would be ideally done, would have law enforcement professionals, mental health professionals, social workers, and of course, depending on the setting, if it's a university, maybe, you know, human resources people, academics, whatever. But the idea would be intervene, help the person, and don't wait till there is a reason to arrest. So had that model been used, perhaps that incident could have been averted. Although clearly, again, not blaming anybody, that law enforcement agency or that mother.
Right.
There's no perfect, but an approach that looked at it as a problem to be solved and not a crime to be prevented might have been helpful.
So, but does that include a higher standard for gun ownership?
I'm not sure it includes a higher standard for gun ownership. I do think it would lead to the idea that a threat assessment team might go, if a state has a red flag law, and be able to say, we'd like to temporarily take a gun away from this person. And that would have to be done with all due process rights and everything else that goes along with that. So it would be on an individual basis. We're not trying to predict people who are going to be violent. We're saying this person appears, but based on their behavior, to be heading towards violence. And might we be able to intervene with a red flag law? Yes.
Okay. So at the other side of that, when you're talking about reporting to law enforcement, there are communities that don't feel comfortable, maybe immigrants without documentation, or I'm thinking of minority communities with all the police shootings. In 2015, we had a police shooting of Osama Rahim here in Boston. Family reached out. I mean, there are serious concerns with reaching out to law enforcement that things could escalate because of that.
I think that's obviously a risk, right? That's true. And there's not a perfect answer to that. But if a threat assessment team in a community included law enforcement, but also included, as I said, social workers, could be religious leaders, mental health practitioners. The idea would be spread the word that threat assessment is not about arrest and prosecution. That may be a result, and that's always a risk, right? But the idea would be, can we provide services? So, for example, Virginia is a state that, for obvious reasons, has mandated threat assessment teams in its schools, universities, high schools, and middle schools. It's used widely. Hundreds to thousands of people are reported. Students are reported every year. The vast majority of them stay in school. They're not suspended, expelled, or prosecuted. And the primary response is providing services. If that model were used elsewhere in the country, I would hope that people would feel more comfortable reporting it because it's less law enforcement and more problem solving.
Do you think or worry at all about the – once you start talking about, okay, watching and reporting each other, the Big Brother aspect, the idea that we're all kind of monitoring each other and the thought police basically, is that something you think about?
Absolutely. That's a very good question, and of course that's a concern. I would say this. I would like to move away from the idea of it being the thought police because, again, this is based on behaviors. And I suppose if you're making threats and saying wild things that's thinking, but it's also behavior, right? So it would be behavior-based. It's also community-based. You're right. We're asking people to watch out for each other. I would like to think that people would do that anyway. And again, if it's about watching each other so we can provide help to those in need and less about persecuting and prosecuting those we don't like, I think the model could be successful. But what you raise is a clear risk and something that needs to be handled carefully and judiciously.
I'm wondering, I think some folks might see, okay, this is a report authored for the FBI. It's advocating for expansion of law enforcement resources. Is there an inherent conflict of interest there?
That's also a very good point. And I'd like to say that the findings in that report are echoed in many other research done by private entities, other research I've done, other research that my colleagues in this field have done. So the idea of using threat assessment and trying to make it more of a national model does come in part from law enforcement, but I think it comes just from good research and the outcomes that we found in privately funded or non-law enforcement funded research.
I just want to note, I misspoke earlier. Osama Rahim's family, as far as we know, did not reach out to law enforcement. I was just trying to use that as an example of how things can escalate quickly. So I think we can all agree that we want to stop or at least curtail these mass shootings. So how do we – it's such a divisive issue. Anytime this type of thing happens, we see everybody runs to their political corners. How do we come together and actually change the culture on this?
I'd like to think that the threat assessment approach is one way to do that because, again, what we're talking about is we're not saying there's a class of people who can't own weapons or a class of people who should be afraid to own weapons or we should be afraid of. What we're saying is individual people at different points in their lives have stresses, have responses that are violent, and those people we should be able to help if we can. We may not be able to. Obviously, we won't find everybody, But this is more of a providing of services to individuals who've shown us that they're a threat. And so I would hope that it's not seen as a big brother approach to monitoring everybody, and it's not necessarily a gun control approach. It's a providing services approach.
That's James Silver, assistant professor of criminal justice at Worcester State University. He's the co-author of a 2018 study for the FBI titled A Study of the Pre-Attack Behaviors of Active Shooters in the United States Between 2000 and 2013. Professor Silver, thanks so much for coming in.
You're welcome. I appreciate it. Thank you.